Operating an economically successful dairy farm while also restoring and working with nature is not only possible, but is potentially more financially favourable. This is the approach of Garob Meher, who has 80 hectares in Limerick. He keeps one of the last remaining purebred Frisian herds in the country.
We're a spring calving herd, so we calve. We're milking 80 cows on... The total farm is 80 hectares, but it's in three divides. So the cows are milked on an actual 32 hectare block, which is about 80 acres. So it's about a cow to the acres, the stocking rate and the milking platform. We're a spring calving herd. We start calving the end of January right up till the end of March, maybe the first week of April. We keep all our calves, we sell them as yearlings. We have a pedigree herd, so we sell some pedigree bull calves for breeding, we sell some pedigree heifers for replacement for other herds, and we keep most of our replacement heifer calves ourselves. And we'd sell off some pedigree cows to other farmers that are looking to increase their genetics in other herds. So the farm is quite heavy. The soil type is quite heavy here, so there's a lot of care needed for the soil, because a lot of damage can be done in the springtime and in the wintertime. So there's a big focus on animal welfare because of that. Our winter can be long here. You know, we could have the cows housed for 6 months of the year. So, you know, the 80 cows have access to 100 cubicle beds. So basically, there's 100 lie down areas for 80 cows. So there's always enough space. And on those lie-down spaces, there's mattresses, so they all have a mattress each, so there's no issue with cows getting sore feet or sore limbs or getting stiff. There's head space in for 100 cows, and there's 80. So there's never a challenge for younger stock eating with older stock. And then we have a brush in, because animals like to scratch. They like to scratch a lot, so we put in an automated brush. There's always some animal under it. I suppose when you mind the animals, and the plus side in, they produce, you know, they, without pushing them at all, like, they end up producing a lot of milk and producing healthy calves. So
yeah,
it makes my job easier and it makes their job easier.
Your own journey onto this farm, you inherited a kind of a slightly more intensive farm, but slowly started to change that system. Can you remember what caused you to pivot your ideas around this, and what were the first kind of changes you started making?
When I got the farm here at home, my father would have been sick for most of his life, so the farm was actually leased out for a period of time and had almost gone derelict. So the farmer that was farming it kind of had was fairly intensive, and kind of had the place was wrecked. Like, it was all the water courses were damaged, all the fields were poached. With very little biodiversity anywhere. I would have always been into the environment and conscious of nature and biodiversity. I kind of started with 40 cows when I took over the farm here. And at that time, I was in Ed College, and well, I just finished Ed College, and it was a big push on to go up cow numbers and increase the national herd, and milk quotas were going, and you know, it was almost gone to, the advice was nearly gone to 2 cows to the acre. I started with 40 cows, and I grew naturally. So as the cows calved, the more heifer calves I produced. If I felt the farm was growing more grass, I kept them. And if it didn't, they were sold to other farmers that were looking for replacement stuff. But like, as I said, I grew it naturally. We didn't push the land. We soil test every 2 years, and we identify what each field needs, and whatever that field requires, that's what that field will get, and it doesn't get over and above. We've GPS for spreading fertilizer, and we have the low emission slurry spreading. Basically, what the low emission slurry spreading is the slurry is released underneath the grass on the ground, so you get no ammonia losses to the atmosphere. So you're basically keeping all your nitrogen, and it's all available for the grass. So there's a lot of homework to be done to do that. Like, you're You're constantly doing nutrient management plans each year. You're soil testing every 2 years. You're testing your slurry to see what the nutrient value is inside in the slurry, and you're putting that with the soil. So there's a lot of science behind it. That determines then what chemical fertilizer we require.
And did you find it easy to kind of start doing, you know, going into testing soils and doing a nutrient management plan? Was the advice out there for you to start looking about how to understand your own land's limits and how to optimize on what you had?
The advice was there, but the advice was always more. So like you address your soil fertility, and then you buy in all your chemical P and K and your nitrogen to get as much out of the soil as possible. My ethos here was always maintaining. So whatever we took off the land, we put back, and we weren't putting on any excess. So whatever the land grew, it grew. When I went through ag college and did the degree in ag science, and it's all about productivity. In the last 20 years, farmers have been trying to increase productivity because that's what we've been taught. And it's always been taught, you know, the better farmers are making more profit. I don't think people realized the impact that had on biodiversity and soil health and water quality. And it's only now, in the last couple of years, we're beginning to realize. Some farmers are kind of turning a blind eye to it, but the likes of myself and other farmers were kind of saying, yeah, we don't need to be.
And how important to your business is the environment, like working alongside the environment?
We are farming the environment. So like the one thing I've tried to achieve here on my farm is that you can still look after the environment and keep space for nature while also maintaining productivity. When I say productivity, I mean milk output.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of litres we send to our co-op hasn't changed. I also maintain it takes a better farmer to be an organic farmer than a conventional farmer, because you have all those luxuries of, oh, I can just spread fertiliser if grass growth is poor.
So you feed your cattle mostly off your own land, but you're not relying on external factors for this in the winter, especially when you have them inside sometimes, you said, for about 5 months, 6 months.
You're trying to get them out to grass as soon as possible in the springtime and keep them out as late as you can in the wintertime. But the weather dictates everything, so there's no 2 years the same. So, yeah, sometimes we might have a four-month winter. Other times it could go to 6 months. So with the type of cow we have here, we have the traditional British Friesian. We always had that type of cow here, and I kind of kept it going. And there's only a handful of pedigree British Friesian herds in the country. With the British Friesian, then, they're very low maintenance. So, like, they don't require any feed for the winter time. So when they come to the end of their lactation, or when they stop supplying milk, each cow gets 2 months of a break. So they're rested for 2 months during the winter.
Mm.
And basically, they get kind of a traditional hay style meadow hay, where it is fairly coarse. Because basically what we're trying to do is, we don't want our cows getting fat, and we don't want them getting too thin, because you need to, you know, it's like anyone, you need to stay fit. Those type of cows, if they get any half decent quality silage, they'll put on a lot of weight. they get fat, like, so. And if they get fat and they calve down, it causes an awful lot of metabolic disorders. They get milk fever, and we'll have a lot of vet bills. So you just have to monitor how fat they get. So this old style traditional hay that we cut in late July is super firm, because it's got enough in it to maintain them but not put on a lot of weight. And the benefit of that hay then is it doesn't get any chemical fertilizer, it doesn't get any chemical sprays. It's an organic type of hay, and it's cut in late July. So any ground nesting birds that might be in those fields would have left at that stage, and there's plenty of those wildflowers in it that they'd be kind of gone off the reproductive stage at that point. So that growing that stuff particularly is has a huge biodiversity benefit, and it also has a huge benefit for the type of cows we have. So if we then, that's for the 2 months for the dry period. So when they start to calve down again, and if the land is too wet, we house them. They're still housed. So we target giving those cows in our better silage. So our better silage would be our good short green grass.
Mm.
And basically, it's it's almost like what they graze in the field. And that would get a small bit of, that would get some chemical nitrogen, because you have to remember grass needs nitrogen to grow. And if you want to produce high quality silage, you need a little bit of nitrogen, because nitrogen is what gives you the grass to grow at a certain rate. And it also adds to the protein in the silage. So like we'd be getting very low yields on those fields because we're looking for quality.
Mm.
And basically, because we've gone for quality, we've also got the protein in the grass. So by having the protein in the grass silage, it has reduced the amount of protein we need to buy in. So that has reduced our protein in the form of soya that we would have been feeding from, that comes in from South America.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, to balance in with energy, then we buy sugar beet that might be grown 20 miles away, 40 miles away, but it's a super feed in the fact that they're basically giving the cow sugar. It gives them great energy. It's the cows are in super condition after them, like they'd be shining, like so. You get very little sick cows on it, because even if a cow is sick after calving or whatever, they might refuse the silage. They won't refuse the sugar beet.
And, oh, you all like a bit of sweetness.
Yeah. And you know, like that sugar beet has it's locally grown. It has reduced our bought in feed or bought in ration by half, you know, so it's huge. And the fact that we're getting that good silage with the high protein, we're reducing the need for protein as well. Because you need two things for cows to produce milk and to stay healthy. Because we have to remember here, if you have a cow and you need to maintain her body condition. So some cows are genetically will produce more milk than other cows. So really, really what you want to do with what I try to do here is have a uniform herd, so all the cows are kind of doing the same and they'll all get the same diet.
Mm.
But like, it's not a thing where we try and feed the cow to produce more milk. We're feeding the cow to maintain what she needs. So we're trying to nutritionally. So if she's producing X amount of liters, we're giving her the proper diet that she requires for that, as opposed to giving her high levels of protein, because protein will drive milk output. And some farmers, you know, they'd be buying in soya straight, they'd be buying in boar's grain and different high protein feeds, and that'll drive milk output. While we test our silage, we test the different feeds or the beet and stuff, and we'd make up a diet and we'd know then, right, the cow needs, if the silage tests X, well then we'll know how much beet to give them, and we'll know then in the parlour how much dairy ration they need.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a case of we'll just give them X, Y, and Z. Because you don't want to run into a situation where the cows are underfed. Because if they're underfed, they start to lose condition, they'll start to, their fertility will drop, and also the milk output will drop.
So you're a cow an acre on part of your farm, but the rest of your farm, you actually focus on, you know, getting the feed right. So you're not bringing in too many inputs apart from your sugar beet, which is only bought in kind of relatively local. So the economics of that is, while you're not, down the kind of the mad expansion treadmill, that you've actually kind of kept your herd back, the cow is healthier, but also because you're able to depend on what's within your own farm gate, you're able to kind of manage exactly what you're producing in terms of your silage and your hay, etc., so that it's kind of optimum for the cow. Is that right?
Exactly. And that's why, you know, if I had 10, 20 extra cows, I wouldn't be able to get that high quality silage, because I just wouldn't have enough ground to do it. Because you take a silage yield, say, off land, like before, farmers would be getting 10 bales to the acre of silage. I'm just using bales as an example. And that would be high volume, low quality. So you've a lot of silage, but very little quality. And given that to cows after calving is a disaster. It's a bit like giving a trained athlete burgers and chips for dinner. They're not going to perform in it. So, like, cows are the very same, they're athletes, like, you know, and you have to treat them like they, you know, it's a minefield. The nutrition is a minefield, but we're not driving them on. We're not, you know, they get everything they require. So if they start producing more milk, we give them what they need to maintain that. But we're not giving them extra to get more out of them, if you know what I mean. But
and Garud, I mean, with your, you do soil testing, you do kind of, you're looking at multi-species swards, you're putting kind of more clover into your silage, you've got your nutrient management plan. A lot of this would be second nature to some farmers, but a lot of it would be quite daunting to start moving into kind of understanding their own land so much that they actually kind of have to look at the science a bit more. What would you say to that farmer? What's the kind of key advice that you would say to any farmer that's kind of considering the economics of bringing in external inputs, and for the cow and for the farm? What would you say to that farmer?
Yeah, like if the, I suppose just on the fertilizer side and that side of the inputs, like this year was the silver lining behind the high prices was that farmers actually looked at their slurry more and said, God, we have a fierce valuable resource here. We should be using it better. And if you don't have soil results or soil samples taken, you have no idea of what fields need the slurry the most. So if you're spreading it in the same fields year on year, those fields are going to be very high for nutrients, while you could have fields that get very little nutrients and are growing very little grass. And if you were to just alter how you spread your slurry, you could grow more grass on the other side of the farm, while the fields that have high level of nutrients, they're the ones that are at risk of them polluting the water course, because the ground can only take so much. Mm-hmm. And like the one thing I always say to farmers is, like, you can't manage something you don't measure. You know, and there's a lot of farmers complaining about this new fertilizer register coming, where farmers will have to register what fertilizer they buy, and they'll need soil sample results, and they'll only be able to buy the amount of fertilizer they need. So in actual fact, what I've been doing here for the last number of years is actually what the government are enforcing on farmers now. And there's a lot of, I suppose, which kind of farmers up in arms about it. But I'm trying to explain to them, you know, lads, this is a win-win. I said, number one, farming is a science. And I said, there's a lot of homework to be done before you do anything. So this is part of it. I said, like, and now that you're being forced to do it, I said, we should embrace it with open arms. Mm-hmm. And by doing this, the flip side is it's better for the environment, because we can now manage what we're doing with our nutrients. While before, you know, it's crazy when you think about it. A farmer could go in and buy an Arctic load of fertilizer and not really knowing what he required.
Mm-hmm.
He was just buying it because on price, or that's what he's been doing for the last 20 years, and he's been spreading it for the last 20 years the same way. So I think going forward with all these restrictions that are coming, I don't see them as restrictions. I think they're necessary, and I think any farmer that's up in arms about it, like, you know, they need to question, like, why are they farming? Because I think this, by doing what the government are coming up with, the farms will actually might have more money in their pocket, and it'll be better for the environment. So
you've got quite a low stocking rate, but you still milk twice a day, Garud. Can you tell me why and the benefits of doing this why you chose not to milk just once a day?
Yeah, so the reason why we milk twice a day is because the cows want to be milked twice a day. So, like, you take a cow and she goes out to graze, and she's chewing the cud, she's producing milk. And by 5 o'clock, all those cows are at the gap, wait to come in, because there's pressure on the udder. And when they come in to get milk, it releases endorphins, and they actually enjoy being milked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why you do them twice a day. While if you had a very low yield and herd, there wouldn't be the same pressure on the cows udder, so they wouldn't look to be milked twice a day. But like, if you take your big Holstein cow, your North American Holstein cow, those cows are milked 3 times a day. And it's not by, it's just that they're producing so much milk. That's why they're milked 3 times a day, because it would actually be, if you had a cow, a very high yielding cow, and you only decided to milk her once a day, it would have a huge impact on the cow's health, because it's a bit like a cow wanted to be milked. It's a bit like trying to hold in your wee, you know, you're kind of waiting to go to the toilet. That's what it's like. You know, you'd see all the cows at the gap and they're all dropping milk, and they'll go into the parlour there, and you know, as soon as they go in, then you can just see them relaxing, because they're whatever hormones it releases. That's why it's a bit like, I often said the cows, you'd nearly swear they had a watch or a clock, because they're never late. Like, they're always at the gap on time, morning and evening. You know, and it's funny, this time of the year, when it comes to drying off, where the cows aren't milking as much, you notice a thin, that's when you'd go on once a day, because they're not looking to be milked twice a day. So if the cows look to be milked 3 times a day, we'd milk them 3 times a day, but they don't. So we just, that's right.
So you have quite a progressive farm, but not at the expense of the environment as well. How does this make you feel?
I'm still a young farmer, so you'd like to... I'm progressive in the fact that we really want to stay efficient and productive, but also a big push on for the environment as well. So like the fact that we're planting 1,500 metres of hedging, and we have a lot of hedging put in anyway, and we have a lot of trees planted, but we're always looking at, you know, these things that we put in on farm won't affect... aren't going to affect the overall productivity of the farm. And even at the moment, we're changing the parlour, the milking parlour. So we're adding a few more units, and we're putting in a variable milk speed pump. So there'll be less electricity used at milking, and there'll be less cooling time for the milk. And the cows will actually be milked faster. Not each cow won't be milked individually faster, but it just means... milking was normally an hour and a half, so that meant the cows were standing around for maybe an hour and a half. So now they'll only be standing for maybe 45 minutes. So the way I look at that is, you're reducing the waiting time for the cows, and it's also freeing up my day as well. Like, so, but that's all part of the progressive farming. I see it is that, how can we reduce our inputs? It's a bit like what I was saying about the clover and the silage fields. It's something that you kind of have to bring the farm over a number of years. You can't just decide, oh, I'm getting rid of all my inputs. Because if you take out an input, there needs to be something there in place already to replace that input. So like, we're starting now to put in the red clover. We have a lot of white clover in the grazing ground, so that has reduced a lot of the fertilizer requirement on the grazing ground. You know, we bought in the beet, and that has reduced the level of dairy nuts, dairy ration that the cows require. We focused on better quality silage, and that has really helped maintain the farm productivity during the winter period. You know, it's not something you can just flick of a light switch and change it. There's a lot of homework, I call it. That's, you know, the nutrient management plan and the soil testing. A lot of people would see that as laborious work, and it can be laborious. But you're kind of shooting in the dark unless you're doing it. Like,
Gerard, is there one memory in particular when you're on your farm and you thought, do you know what? I love where I live. I love where I work. I love what animals I produced. Is there one memory that stands out for you in particular that you feel proud that you could hand this farm over to the next generation in its best possible kind of balance?
Yeah, like that's, I suppose we're on the road of, I'm not there yet, but we're getting there. Like, it's And even it's funny, a lot of the farmers around have latched onto it, and even our local co-op that I supply have latched onto it. But the one thing I will notice was, I had, and you see, because I'm here the whole time, I don't notice it that much, but I had judges out for the Milk Quality Awards, and the one thing they noticed, they couldn't get over the amount of wildlife and the noise of all the birds on the farm. And I was like, Jesus, is that not, you know, I'm listening to that the whole time. I was like, is that not normal? And they said, Jesus, they couldn't get over it. And like, it's only when other people come in to look, I begin to realize, Jesus, what I've done. And it's funny, I hosted a farm walk here a couple of weeks back, and it was the local co-op ran it, but it was through Chagas. And Chagas, you know, read the farm profile, you know, we've limited our sprays, we've limited our fertilizer, we've limited our feed. But they were shocked when they actually looked at the milk figures. Where actually our herd is performing as well as the top 10% of herds in the country. But yes, we're feeding far less, we're spreading far less, and we're managing to get in all these trees and these hedges without any effect on the farm. Like, and they were a bit speechless when they saw the
proof in the pudding. Yeah.
So I said, I didn't realize myself. I said, look, so I'm only doing, I'm only looking after the place as best I can. I wasn't out to produce the figures that the herd is producing. You know, you get up every morning, you do the same thing. You know, you look after the land and the cows as best you can. And I think the proof is in the pudding that sometimes less is more. And even the one thing I've noticed is, I've been doing this selective dry cow, and basically what selective dry cow is, when you dry off your cows for the winter, basically when you stop them from milking, you give the cows an antibiotic so they don't get an infection. Before, the whole herd across the farm would get an antibiotic. That was just the normal thing. So now there's a big talk about antibiotic resistance. So there's been a big push to go selective. So basically what they're doing is you're only selecting certain cows for antibiotics. And that's compulsory now this year. So I knew this was coming. So I started doing that selective dry cow back in 2015. And at first we did half the herd. We stopped doing half the herd with antibiotics. And then that became less and less. And now we've got it down to, we're only doing about 10% of the herd with antibiotics. And those 10% of the herd actually need the antibiotics, because when we milk record, we get back a figure for the other health of the cow. So it's called the somatic cell count. So basically the somatic cell count is the number of white blood cells in the cow's udder. So if that's at a certain level, that means she's producing a lot of white blood cells, which means she has infection. So what we started doing was any cow that had a somatic cell count of over 200,000 in the udder would get an antibiotic, because there's some level of infection there. While cows underneath that, I felt, were kind of able to, if they were in good condition and there was a good environment, they could fight the infection themselves. So since I started doing that, we use very little antibiotics now, because the cows have automatically, their immunity has grown it by themselves by not me giving them antibiotics. So it actually has lowered my overall cell count, the somatic cell count. And it has, I'd say, I use 4 or 5 mastitis tubes through the whole year. While, you know, some farmers could use a box of mastitis tubes in the springtime.
It seems you're not chasing kind of expansion targets. Instead, you're letting your animals thrive, but also letting nature thrive as well as a result. And what's really interesting is it sounds like it's also working for you economically as well. Gaurav Maher, thanks very much for being my guest today.
Thanks, man.
This interview was part of our online Ask the Farmer Q&A series throughout the winter. More details to come on farmingfornature.ie. Meanwhile, if you'd like this podcast, please rate and review. It helps us spread the word.